You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 291, Exodus 21 to 23, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We're a couple weeks into the season now, Trey. How are you doing?
I'm not too good, Mike. Still looking for my first win. And you?
Right. Well, I got one.
Yeah.
Tim, the defending champion, I mean, his team's looking good. He's 2-0.
Yeah.
He said that. We're recording this. So yeah. I play him next. So, you know, hopefully he'll have a bad week.
Yeah. Hopefully. Well, his Georgia Tech team's not having a good year either. So at least I can have that over Tim. But we won't talk about that.
Yeah, I don't follow college football.
Since you're going to.
Yeah, I can't rub it in.
Since you're moving to Jacksonville, how do you like Minshew, the new quarterback?
I watched him, in that Thursday night game. He doesn't look like a rookie. So that's good. I think they'll do fine with him.
Yeah, I love his look. You're going to have to grow out a mustache. Yeah.
You know, that's what I can't figure with the mustache thing, because Aaron Rodgers had a mustache for years. What's the difference?
It's funny. It's just funny. That's all it is.
Well, maybe it's because he's just a goofball or something.
Well, yeah,
I don't know.
That's what it is.
I don't see any visual difference. You know what ought to happen is when Nick Foles comes back to the lineup, he should like have a mustache. Go out to the field.
Do you think you'll check out some games when you move there?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll go to at least one. You know, I've been to a game. There's some people at the church, you know, who played for the Jags, you know, in years past and have connections there. So I'm sure we'll go to a game at some point.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, but I think I've said it before in the show. I've actually been to a game there, and I got to see Barry Sanders run his last year there. So that place is special to me because I at least got to see Barry Sanders live.
Yeah, really?
So it's a nice thing.
Yeah, now people are like, enough with the sports talk, but we've had encouragement there, Trey. Why don't you just drop this on our audience?
Yeah, I know. Jared, I'll give him a shout out. He's a new listener. He came over from the Bible Project, and he sent us some courage, and he's a football fan himself, so he said it helps, it humanizes the show in his opinion. So there you go, Mike. We got at least one. And I've had others, don't get me wrong. There have been other emails.
It's nice to know that what we do here is either dehumanizing or non-human or robotic or something like that. That's good.
Well, I guarantee you we're probably the only in-depth Bible study podcast that talks about sports too. So
it talks about, okay. Well, all right. If that's the point, I can accept that.
We appreciate Jared listening to us now, and everybody that sends me an email. Again, I apologize. I can't get to everybody, but Mike, I get so many emails now.
that one drew your attention.
yeah, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. I try to read all of them, and especially when somebody mentions football, that sticks with me. Thanks, Jared.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, we're wrapping up.
I was going to say Exodus 21 and 23 may not be as interesting as football, but here we go.
Hey, it's all right. So this is the last part two, right? We're only going to be two parts of the laws. We're wrapping up the laws,
just,
I guess.
Just two parts. Yep. Book of the Covenant. This is part two. There will not be a part three. We'll be moving on. And I remember, last time we said we have to, it's time to do a Q&A. So this will be it for the Book of the Covenant. All right. Well, as I, hinted last time in part one, what we're going to do is just sort of cherry pick our way through Exodus 21 through 23, stopping, of course, at the point where God has this conversation with Moses about the angel that he's going to send before the Israelites into the land. So that's where we'll pick up in Exodus after this. But as far as just sort of, again, picking our way through this, that's going to be our method. We could be here for, several weeks, if we paused, really a month, if we paused all the laws, and I'm not going to do that because our method here isn't verse by verse, strictly anyway. It's just stuff that, again, I think is kind of interesting. But if you haven't listened to part one, you need to, because, we sort of made the point, that this is a real, this whole section has given scholars a lot of trouble because a lot of things in it either don't seem to be interrelated to each other or seem to be contradicted in other parts of the Torah. And we talked about why that is. Essentially, this is a section that applies principles from the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And that's what I want to do this time. I'm going to pick out a few examples. We'll talk about what they mean. And, you know, but more importantly, you know, sort of how they riff off of, you know, something in the Decalogue. So to open here in Exodus 21, the first six verses, I'm not going to say much really of anything about the first six verses because we actually talked about this passage, Exodus 21, 1 through 6, in an earlier episode, specifically in relation to the myth that the Elohim of passages like Psalm 82 are just men. That was episode 249. Now you might say, well, what does that have to do with Exodus 21? Well, it does. I'll tell you a little bit about that here in a second here. But also Exodus 22, verses 7 through 9, was looped into that discussion. So when we hit Exodus 22, 7 through 9, we're not going to stop there either. The issue in Exodus 21, and again, there's a parallel to this in Exodus 22, that section. The issue is in verse 6, where, you know, this is Exodus 21, 1 through 6 is, you know, when the slave of the house, you know, wants to join the household, the house, and it's the whole thing. You know, I love my master, my wife, my children. I don't want to go free. So then the master, you know, brings him to Elohim in verse 6. Then his master shall bring him to Elohim, and he shall bring him to the door of the doorpost. His master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall be a slave forever. Well, people who want the Elohim in Psalm 82 will say that that verse, Exodus 21, 6, means that the master will bring him to the gods, plural, in other words, the Israelite judges. But of course, the passage never says that. And as we noted earlier in this series and episode 249, the judges of Israel are never called Elohim in any passage of the Bible, period. So, you know, this is something that has to be sort of made up and inserted into the narrative. Now, the issue is a little more complicated when you look at the parallel passage of the slave who wants to join the household in Deuteronomy, because in that passage, the part about bringing him, the slave, to Elohim is omitted. In episode 249, we asked why. I mean, why would you do that? If the reference is to God, singular, capital G-O-D, why take God out of the picture? It doesn't make any sense. If it's to human judges, which of course it isn't, but let's pretend, if it's the references to human judges, why would you take them out? That doesn't make any sense either. And the answer, as we talked about in episode 249, is something Cyrus Gordon published years ago, that the writer of Deuteronomy, or at least this passage, writing in 8th century or so, again, I'm not a JEDP guy, but there are differences of date in passages within the Torah. We've talked about that a number of times. We've actually demonstrated, illustrated a few. Part one of this particular section of Exodus was more of the same in that regard. But if he's writing in the 8th century, he omitted the Elohim apparently because the term Elohim could have been construed as plural and a reference to household ancestors, the dead. In which case he may have feared, the writer may have feared people would make images to the ancestors or otherwise drift into idolatry. And by the way, the Exodus passage, that's the Deuteronomy passage where this is omitted. The Exodus passage, you know, you could read that way too. Then his master shall bring him to Elohim, again, the ancestors of the household. You know, but Exodus doesn't have the same problematic historical background as Deuteronomy. Again, presuming the passage is 8th century or so, which is, you know, again, when Israel was caught in idolatry and it had to have reforms under kings like Josiah. Okay, now I tend to think the household ancestors are in view in both passages. I think that's coherent. In Exodus, you could certainly have it to capital G-O-D. But it's very workable with household ancestors in both passages. And, you know, it's not a hill I'd die on, but, you know, this law would be an extension. If that's the case, this case law, Exodus 21, 1 through 6, would be an extension of honoring your father and your mother. That's how it would connect to the Decalogue. Their approval, the approval of your ancestors, is needed for an outsider to join the family. Okay, there's a ritual of approval here, as it were. Now, Gordon's explanation that the Elohim here are the household ancestors family members, deceased family members, has 1 Samuel 28 in mind. This is where Elohim refers to the disembodied human dead, which is a very common usage of the term Elohim in the ancient Near East. I think it makes good sense. Elohim, again, as I talk about an unseen realm a lot, we've done a number of episodes. Again, episode 249 is the one to go to. Elohim is really any being by nature that is a disembodied member of the spiritual world. That's why Elohim as a term is applied to the deceased human dead in 1 Samuel 28, and again, presumably or potentially here. Now, incidentally, this is also good evidence that the Israelites didn't believe in soul sleep and didn't deny an afterlife. You know, we could, you know, if they're doing this, you know, bringing the slave, you know, to puncture his ear on the doorpost of the house, and they're bringing him before the Elohim, again, in other words, their dear departed loved ones. This would make a lot of sense, both in the cultural context, in the context of 1 Samuel 28, which, by the way, would have been written at the same time as the at least the passage in Deuteronomy. Again, if that section is late, you know, it makes good sense, and this is not in and of itself like a bad thing. I mean, we kind of listen to that and it's like, what? You know, like the Israelites are, you know, still thinking their dead loved ones are alive and they're like doing ceremonies to honor them. And yeah. And you know what, listener, you do too. You know, you have, this is why you put flowers at a grave. This is why you visit a grave and talk, you know, to the deceased, because you assume that the person is still around, still alive. I mean, they're not bodily alive. And this is the same kind of thing. You know, why do we do nice things for the dead? It's to honor them, you know, whether it's putting a stuffed animal at a grave or flowers or cards or whatever. Okay, you know, we have this assumption that we're being watched, or that the departed person will know what's going on and appreciate it. This is just normal stuff. It's very normal. It's not idolatry or anything like this. And you could bring up the teraphim. And we talked about, you know, teraphim in other episodes, again, including, I believe, in episode 249. But the teraphim were figurines. They're in several biblical passages. And in the context of a couple of those, they could be human in appearance. Again, you know, even if they're figurines of the dead, that doesn't mean they're being worshipped. You know, the Old Testament equivalent of having, you know, pictures of dead loved ones are the teraphim. They don't have cameras, but they can make images and keep them around the house to remind them of their ancestors. You know, this is, you know, part of what they're thinking. It's very human behavior. Again, it's not necessarily anything forbidden. It could cross a line for sure, especially in Old Testament culture. And so the writer of Deuteronomy might have been, you know, had the jitters because, hey, we've just lived through a few decades, maybe a couple centuries of idolatry, and you know, God hates this. So we need to learn, you know, we need to just sort of cut this off at the bud and going the extra mile. You know, like Gordon argues, it's conceivable that they could have taken the word Elohim out because of this fear. So it's not a necessary conclusion that people would take, but again, the writer might have jitters. Again, it in context, again, especially if that is the context, Israelite apostasy after the monarchy splits up, it makes a lot of sense. You know, but again, that's Exodus 21, 1 through 6. If you want, you know, the detailed information, listen to episode 249. So if we go to beyond that, 7 through 11, I'm just going to read, you know, sections of this. So we have what follows. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So that's verses 7 through 11. Now, you know, ultimately what this is about is truth-telling. And really, conceivably, theft. You say, how? Well, because the guy, you know, either sells his daughter as a slave, you know, to a servant or, you know, some other household or whatever, for whatever the circumstance would be. You know, we're not told what it is. But if that daughter doesn't please the master can't just sort of kick her out and she has nothing. She has no way to sustain herself. She's allowed to be redeemed. You know, that you know, the money that was paid out, you know, in exchange for her, you know, there's this concept of a dowry, would either be given back to her or the father, and she's brought back into the home. You know, in some way, she's going to be taken care of because the guy promised to support her. And there was a dowry exchange here, so he can't just renege on that. So there's an issue of theft. There's also an issue of truth telling. You know, that he, you know, said he would, you know, honor this agreement and protect her and keep her. And again, if he designated her for his son, let's say the guy buys this girl and with the intent that he's going to give the girl to marry his son, then he's supposed to deal with her like he would his own daughter. Again, she's to be taken care of. So yes, it's a patriarchal society. Yes, you know, it's you know, primitive by our standards, you know, all those things. Okay, I get it. But we need to look beyond this, you know, that these passages aren't endorsing doing this today because we don't live in a theocracy. The theocracy, by definition, was planned obsolescence. If you're paying any attention at all to salvation history in biblical theology from one end of the Bible to the other, Genesis to Revelation, you know, even in Genesis, you are taught that ultimately the theocracy, the theocratic state that will come later, is not designed to be permanent. Everything is supposed to go back to the way it was in Eden, where you've got equality. You have equality. God wants people in his family. The ground is level there, all that sort of thing, an Edenic world. This is where things are supposed to go back, you know, after the fall and after all the other, you know, the three rebellions in Genesis 1 through 11 that take place to corrupt humanity and you know, assist humanity in its own self-destruction. That's not supposed to be cured by the theocracy. The theocracy is a way station. It's a stopping point along the way. It's a temporary situation. So we don't have here a contradiction of that idea, and we know it would be a contradiction because we're reading the rest of the Bible. We're reading beyond, you know, the book of Exodus here, the Torah. You know, we know the rest of the story. So, you know, you do have issues here of truth telling and theft, you know, avoiding theft. You don't take this money and not give it back. You know, you don't renege support and all this sort of stuff. This is the point to Exodus 7 through 11. That's what we're supposed to go away with. We're not supposed to do as some evangelicals have done, which is rather silly. You know, I think silly is the nice word for it. And pretend like, oh, you know, Bible-believing Christianity, you know, we're supposed to do this stuff now, you know, sell each other and, you know, be polygamous. You know, look, if you think that way, you're close to being biblically illiterate. Let's just leave it there. So we keep reading from verse 12, whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, it sets up an accident circumstance, something unintentional. If he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, again, so maybe this person was deserving of getting a punch in the nose, then I will appoint you for a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. I mean, that's a death penalty offense. So what you really have, I'll stop there, verses 12 through 32. The focus of these cases, these instances, is the thou shalt not murder law of the Decalogue. So in the preceding, you know, verses 7 through 11, you know, again, verses 1 through 6, if we have Elohim being the deceased ancestors, then we have a certain issue there about honoring your father and your mother. Okay, that would be the way that this connects back to the Decalogue. Verses 7 through 11 will be about don't steal. You know, and tell the truth. Okay, honor your commitments. It's honoring a trust. Here, 12 to 32, the focus would be don't commit murder. Again, the focus is on intentional killing. You know, whoever strikes his mother or his father shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. Again, that goes back to the stealing, but also, since kidnapping is a death penalty offense, it could also be again considered, you know, in that day, you know, doing intentional harm that, again, potentially, you know, could result in death. If you're kidnapping someone, it's usually not to do nice things to them, you know, that's sort of thing. So, you could have the theft, you know, command in there as well. You could be committing an act that sort of telegraphs a murderous intention. And so that's why it gets included here. Whoever curses his father or mother shall be put to death. And it's the same thing here. So this whole section is really, again, trying to apply in, you know, the Israelite mindset, the command against murder. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time on a few of these verses because I think they get really misused today to justify abortion. And I'm speaking specifically here of Exodus 21, 22 through 23. So let's just read those. So we've got here verse 22. This is Exodus chapter 21, verse 22. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, and has to pay money, surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life. Okay? Eye for eye, again, this is continuing on in verse 24, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So that was actually 22 through 25. But the key verses are these two, 22 and 23. So in verse 22, you have a struggle, a fight. A pregnant woman gets hit and her children come out, but there is no harm. Again, these are all ambiguous sorts of, you know, phrases, which I'll get to in a second. Then the one who hit her, if there's no harm, shall surely be fined. But if there is harm, verse 23, then it's life for life. Then that's a death penalty issue. Now, let's just talk about the content of the passage before, you know, we get into, you know, why I'm sort of camping here for a little bit. Sarna writes this: unfortunately, the Hebrew text is replete with difficulties, which are further compounded by the attachment of the law of talion. That is, that's eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Lex talion is in Latin. For example, it is not clear why the phrase expressing expulsion of the fetus, the contents of the womb, should speak of children in the plural. Nor do we know whether stillbirth, premature birth, or term delivery is intended. You know, any one of those circumstances could apply. And Sarna adds, nor is it certain to what and to whom the Hebrew ason, here rendered other damage or harm, refers. We don't know what's really in the picture. So we've got some problems here. Again, Sarna, you know, tries to unpack this a little bit. I'm mostly satisfied with this. Children, you know, this is me talking. I think the reason that it's plural is probably to cover the loss or premature birth of more than one child, because they may not necessarily know if it's one or more than one. And so the plural covers that. I think that's the easiest explanation. Sarna notes about the verb come out, which he translates in his commentary, emerge. So if the contents of the womb emerge, they come out. He says here, the term is used of birth elsewhere, though it is not the normative term. And examples would be Genesis 25, 25. The first came out, this is Jacob and Esau. Again, the first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau. So came out, there is the issue. Genesis 38, 28, when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. So, you know, that it's enough of the examples. Came, to come out, you know, yatsah here in Hebrew, could be a verb for birth. It's certainly used that way. Typically, you'd have something like brought forth, okay, you know, something like, you know, trying to remember another, kana is kind of a rare verb, but begot or, you know, when it's used of a woman, you know, she conceived and, you know, brought forth or bore a child. You know, you have yalad in some of these cases and other verbs, but you do have this one that's translated come out. That does occur with birth. So that might actually be in the picture. So you could have a live birth here. You could have a stillbirth, you know, something like an unintentional abortive, you know, circumstance, obviously. We just don't know. Sarna also comments on the term harm. He says, elsewhere, this term signifies a major calamity. It's used in the Joseph story, you know, Genesis 42:4. Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Genesis 44:29. If you take this one also from me and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs to evil and Sheol, when Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin back. So harm is something that's a pretty severe calamity. So does that, is that in view here? Well, probably, again, because the one circumstance might involve the loss of a life, a death penalty offense. Now, Sarna adds, rabbinic tradition construes the phrase in this way, again, some severe harm, and understands it as referring to the mother. And that brings up another issue. Is the harm to the mother or the child? The passage doesn't say. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm. That probably, refers to the kids, but in the next verse, but if there is harm, then you pay life for life. So is one the kid, the other the mother, or both the kids, both the mother, who knows? And verse 23, again, all these issues sort of rolled together, and then verse 23 is really the sticking point nowadays. But if there is harm, again, we don't know if it's mother or child. Now, pro-abortion people, including some Christians, read the passage as follows in light of all this. They would read it this way. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out and are dead, again, we're reading into that, but this is just for illustration. Her children come out and they're dead, but there's no harm to the mother, then the one who hit her shall be fined. But if there is harm, in other words, if the mother dies, then there's life for life. So why it's read that way is this. The mother's life, when it ends, requires the death penalty. And so therefore, ergo, in this interpretation, the mother's life is counted as more than her children. The children are essentially not valued. They're like either not human or subhuman or something like that. They're not really persons. And so the question is then raised, why should we care about abortion? Why should we call abortion murder? This passage isn't, blah, 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 so on and so forth. Now, if we assume the part about the child or the children dying with no recrimination, which again, the text doesn't say, you just have to assume all these things. And by the way, any ethical position based on assumptions isn't really a very good hermeneutic. But again, let's play along. If we assume the part about the child or children dying with no recrimination, is this a correct parsing of the intent of the passage? Is this what the passage means? Is if the kids die and the mother doesn't, are we really supposed to say that the passage intended to teach us that children aren't really persons? Again, I would say the answer is quite obviously no. Now, you get some help here with Hammurabi's Law Code. Hammurabi's Law Code has something really similar to this, that, if you want to defend abortion from this passage, you typically never mention. If you don't, then you're going to mention it because it's pretty close. I'm going to just read you Hammurabi's Code here, sections 209 through 214. If an awilu, an awilu is a classification of a person, sort of like a person of high status, like an elite person, citizen, all that kind of stuff, it's a high social class, okay? If an awilu strikes a woman of the awilu class and thereby causes her to miscarry her fetus, he shall weigh and deliver 10 shekels of silver for her fetus. If that woman should die, they shall kill his daughter. So you have a man of a certain social class strikes a woman of the same class. The woman miscarries. Then the perpetrator, shall weigh and deliver 10 shekels of silver to compensate for the loss of the fetus. But if the woman dies, then the authorities are to kill the offender's daughter. If he should cause a woman of the commoner class, let's say the guy strikes a commoner, and if he shall cause her to miscarry her fetus by the beating, he shall weigh and deliver 5 shekels of silver. If that woman should die, he shall weigh and deliver 30 shekels of silver. If he strikes an awilu's slave woman and thereby causes her to miscarry her fetus, he shall weigh and deliver 2 shekels of silver. If that slave woman should die, he shall weigh and deliver 20 shekels of silver. So you can see that as the social class declines, the amount that needs to be repaid declines. And even if the person of lower social class dies, the penalties are less severe. The point is that Hammurabi's code is not teaching we're assuming that children are not humans. Okay, that isn't the point. It's not even teaching that children are less than human adults, because in the first instance with the upper social class, if we have a death there, again, that's the most severe of the fetal, you know, penalties. You never get a zero, even for a slave woman's, you know, fetus and all that stuff. So it doesn't assume that children aren't human. That isn't the point of these laws. The point of the laws is not about human personhood. It's about social classes. So Israel, believe it or not, Israelite culture had social classes. Adults were a higher social class than children. Why? Because they are capable of doing work. Okay, this is just how the culture works. It's what's going on. So the point of the laws is not, well, you're human and this thing over here isn't. It's not a real person, so you can kill it and who cares? No. And again, that isn't the issue. And plus, again, you have to read all of those circumstances into the passage. The passage never actually says any of those circumstances that are that the pro-abortion person need to be there. The text is not self-evident or even clear in that way at all. But nevertheless, you'll see this passage come up, you know, in quote-unquote biblical defenses of abortion, when it's quite wrongheaded. And the parallels, again, I think are helpful in getting our heads in the right place in terms of the ancient Near Eastern culture. It's about social class. It's not about personhood. Let's move on to Exodus 21, 18 through 32. Or 28 through 32, excuse me. This is the ox goring. So when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall not be liable. Again, this, the first circumstance is that it's an unintentional goring. Why do you put the ox to death? You know, is the ox, a moral character in the story, you know, sentient being? No, you put it to death so it doesn't kill anybody else. It's common sense. You know, it's capable of doing this. It did it once. It was unintentional, but we're getting rid of the ox. Could do it again. And the idea of not eating the ox is that, you know, we don't want, you know, you don't want people going, hey, that guy's ox gored me. Let's put it to death. And man, I could use a steak. Okay. You don't create the circumstance where the circumstances could be manipulated and then, you know, person loses, some livestock and you get a meal. You know, you don't do that either. Okay, so you don't eat it. There's no benefit to it. Verse 29, but if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, maybe it hadn't been reported, maybe it wasn't unto death. Okay. If it's accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or woman, the ox shall be stoned, the owner shall also be put to death. Because this is, again, it's kind of obvious. This is, you know, there's a difference here between accidental resulting in the loss of life and negligence, you know, and personal responsibility. You know, the unintentional thing, you have, you know, some ransom and redemption going on. If a ransom is imposed on him, he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. So even the guy who is responsible here, who didn't heed the warning, could be ransomed here because it's not a premeditated murder. But he was warned and he was negligent, didn't do anything about it. So he could be put to death or he could be ransomed in some way. You know, so this is an application of thou shalt not murder. You know, what's murder? This is an instance that helps us define what murder is, where there is no ransom versus what isn't. And even in the category of what isn't, if a person is just willfully negligent, that person does put his own life in jeopardy. Again, it could be ransom, but you know, it's not a good situation by any stretch of the imagination. So again, these are case laws. They allow interpretation and nuancing of something in the Decalogue. So you go from that point, Exodus 21, 33, all the way into Exodus 22 through 15. It's a string of laws, case laws again, about really that revolve around restitution. Unlawful theft, unlawful taking of property is in view in these. And again, part of this is Exodus 22, 7 through 9, which we touched on in episode 249, so we're not going to worry about it here. But I want to go down to Exodus 22, this is part of this section, 16 and 17, and read that. If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed, and lies with her. He shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. Okay? So Sarna has a comment here. Again, I just think this one's kind of interesting. The Book of the Covenant, again, this whole section, this Exodus 21 through part of 23, the Book of the Covenant does not regulate the laws of marriage, Sarna writes. Long established by custom in Israel, they were transmitted orally over generations. The present law must be an amendment to existing practice. I'm going to stop there. Again, I've made the comment a number of times in our series on Exodus. There are things in the Torah that assume a culture. God doesn't invent a culture out of thin air and say that this is the divine heavenly culture now. We're going to assume polygamy and, you know, no. The Torah assumes certain cultural practices. And again, Sarna is just bringing this point out. The present law must be an amendment to existing practice. The extant corpora of laws from the ancient Near East devote much attention to the case of rape, but none to the specific issue dealt with here. Let me stop there. So here's a case where within an existing body of jurisprudence, ancient Near Eastern jurisprudence, there's something in here that's different in the Israelite way of thinking than other ancient Near Eastern law codes. Back to Sarna. Ibn Ezra, again, a famous rabbinic figure, points out that the sequence of legal topics is from the case of stolen property to that of a stolen heart. Both are offenses that occasion economic loss and entail payment of compensation. A man has seduced an unattached virgin. Again, recall how, again, Israelite culture defined adultery, just like the wider ancient Near Eastern culture. Again, it wasn't a culture that was invented. It was something that was already there. And the Torah assumes these things. And that is, a man cannot, you know, have sexual relations with a married woman or a betrothed woman. But if the woman doesn't fit either of those, he is allowed to add wives. Okay? We talked about this, we talked about it when we hit the thou shalt not commit adultery in our discussion of the Decalogue. So again, just to refresh your memory. So here in this case, a man has seduced an unattached virgin. So she doesn't fit the two categories of adultery that would constitute adultery. Ordinarily, her father would receive the mohar, or bride price, customarily paid him by the husband-to-be. And there are a number of scripts. It's also a biblical Hebrew word. And you'll see the mohar paid in various passages. This is in compensation, Sarna writes, for the loss of the daughter's services and potential value to the family. But the mohar was predicated on the woman's premarital virginity, which was expected on moral and social grounds and was essential to the marriage contract. Thus, the deflowering of the girl caused her a loss of social status and resulted in her father's forfeiture of the mohar. Consequently, the seducer had to make good the lost sum. Regardless of whether the father permitted him to marry his daughter, he's going to have to pay up regardless. The mohar was occasionally paid in services or heroic deeds instead of in money, as was the case with David's marriage to Saul's daughter, Othniel's betrothal to Achsah, the daughter of Caleb, and Jacob's many years of service in return for Laban's two daughters. It's the end of the Sarna quote. Now, it's also to point out some of the issues with terminology, and this is, again, come from Sarna. He writes of the term translated seduces, that the term is of interest because it implies that there was persuasion or deception by the man, but not coercion. It's not rape. There's a presumption of consent on the part of the girl, or again, either she was persuaded or deceived into this. For the law of rape, we get something different than what we read here. That's Deuteronomy 22 through 29, which is much more severe in terms of penalty. The phrase, a virgin who is not betrothed. The Hebrew here is asher lo orasa, and it means that she had never been betrothed before. Okay, that is, she did not previously have a fiancé, a person who had paid the mohar for her but had not yet consummated the marriage. So she hasn't been engaged before, and the price for her has never been paid. You know, that's the circumstance. A biblical marriage, Sarna writes, comprised two separate stages. The first is expressed through the verb stem here, aleph, resh, and then we have samek, if the transliteration is correct here. I'm reading in transliteration, so I can't see the characters. So this from Asher lo orasa. Okay, so aleph, resh, samek, we'll assume here. The first, you know, step here in regard to that term isn't quite known. I mean, it's an uncertain term. It may mean to ask, as in asking for the girl's hand in marriage, but scholars aren't sure exactly what that is. Once the mohar was paid, and that's the second stage, the girl was considered betrothed, okay, and had the legal status of a married woman, even though she was still entirely under the care and authority of her father. And they're not joined as, you know, husband and wife like we would think of it yet, but she is engaged and she has the legal status of a wife, which is again why a man who is married can't come along and take that woman who's betrothed, because she has legal status like she is a wife. And again, that would be adultery. So, you know, you have this, it's an interesting situation here. I thought I would spend a little bit of time unpacking, but what's the teaching point? Well, obviously, it's about stolen property. And we don't like to put it in those terms because we don't view humans as property. And I'm using the term just to sort of, you know, jar you a little bit. It's not that the teaching point isn't that, you know, women are daughters or chattel. The teaching point is that there was an economic exchange when it comes to marriage. And this is part of Western civilization as well, even into the modern era, well into the modern era. If you're a fan of period movies, you know, for instance, you know, you'll see this kind of thing where the household losing the girl was expected to receive a dowry in exchange. Doesn't mean that they were treated as property. It means that their economic value to the household has to be compensated or replaced. Those are two related but different thoughts. Okay, so we don't want to lose the distinction in the thought. Let's move on to Exodus 22. Let's see here, verse 18 on. You've got here categorical prohibitions. So we're moving here a little bit away from case law to things that you just don't do. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. That's 22:18. Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. That's Exodus 22:19. Exodus 22:20. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. Again, it's a death penalty offense. So you've got situations here that, you know, result in very, very severe, you know, death penalty offenses. And you say, well, why, you know, why is this? What's the connection to the Decalogue? The connection to the Decalogue is, at least in the first one, you know, not so obvious. The third one is pretty obvious. Whoever sacrifices to any other god, this is a violation of worshiping only the Lord your God. All three of them are actually that, because the sorceress command has to do with idolatry ultimately, because the sorceress, you know, that's just an English translation, but the person in view here is going to be using divination to not only solicit information from other spiritual beings, i.e. other gods, other Elohim, but the person who is receiving that information could be drawn into an idolatrous, a worship, or, you know, some sort of ritualistic, you know, relationship with that entity, or perhaps the use of images is part of, and in many cases it was, part of the divinatory deed. So the context for this is idolatry, which is a violation, clearly, you know, of you know, the early commands in the Decalogue. That's why we get the death penalty offense here. You know, no other gods. And, you know, when you switch sides, and what's the context here for Exodus 21 through 23? It's not only the meeting at Sinai in Exodus 20, where God's giving the commands. It's also Exodus 24. It's the sealing of the covenantal relationship. When you switch sides, you pay the price, and the price is, you know, death. you don't worship other gods. Period. You've made your decision, and it's a very poor decision. I mean, God has just shown you through, you know, acts that he did in Egypt with the plagues, with the Red Sea, okay, the Passover, you know, the last plague, all that stuff. God has shown you what happens to people who worship other gods. It's not good. So again, the Israelites are going to know this going in. And so to switch sides, it's very obviously contextually going to be a death penalty offense. What about 22:19, bestiality? This is often connected to pagan religious practices. And I'm going to read you a little section from Sarna here. He says, this particular perversion is again prohibited in Leviticus 18:23 and Leviticus 20:15 and 16, where it is presented as one of the abominations of the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Canaan, which in and of itself is interesting because, and I don't want to drift, you know, too far into this, but if you were in Lubbock, you know, for my my Lubbock session about the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Canaan, specifically the Sea Peoples, you know, where we get the giant clans, the Amorites, and all that kind of stuff, you know, just the fact that it was connected to them, it tells you that we have an idolatry situation, idolatry circumstance. You are linking yourself by committing this act with an animal. You have linked yourself with people who are associated ultimately with the chaos that erupted in both Genesis 6 and also at Babel. Again, it's this Amorite, you know, pre-Israelite inhabitant of Canaan connection. Sarna, back to him. He says, it is not known to what extent the biblical allusions are representational of Syro-Palestinian culture. Quite possibly they are aimed at idolatrous practices, otherwise unrecorded, of the official pagan religious or popular cults. Of the law collections of the ancient Near East, only the Hittite laws legislate against bestiality, imposing the death penalty, except, and this is weird, this is an oddity of Hittite law, except for copulation between a human and a horse or mule, which inexplicably is not an offense. It's just weird, but Hittite law is known for this. Hittite ritual texts dating back to the second half of the 13th century BC describe the purificatory rites for the removal of impurity of bestiality and incest from a man in those situations. Otherwise, references to this abomination are restricted to mythological literature and to records of dream experience. And that's the end of the Sarna quote. The mythological reference there is probably Baal. I would say mostly going to be something associated with Baal, which of course is intimately associated with, you know, Amorite sort of situation. Baal copulates with a cow in one Ugaritic text, so that's probably the reference. Again, it's a, you know, it was especially, again, you know, as Israel receives the law, they enter into the covenant, they get into the land, they settle in the land. Again, they're going to become familiar with Canaanite religion too much because they don't drive the inhabitants out completely. You know, we know this from Judges, first chapter of Judges, and they're going to be exposed to this, to stuff about Baal. They're going to have heard this. So again, the law would especially make sense in that way. 22:19, this is the obvious one. You don't sacrifice to the gods of other nations. Interestingly enough, Sarna pulls this out from the Hebrew text. He says, the reference is to the gods of other nations. Okay, I'll read it again. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. So Sarna says, he's right. This is what the Hebrew has. Whoever sacrifices to the gods. And Sarna writes, this understanding is indicated by the vocalization of the Hebrew, La Elohim, as distinct from Le Elohim, which refers to one God, like to God. So if you have the preposition plus Elohim, if it's Le Elohim is the way you would correctly pronounce it. That's to one God. But La Elohim is to the gods, specifically, again, the gods of the nations. And so you're put under the cherem, the devote to destruction law, which was aimed at the people who did those things and ultimately were associated with the Amorites. Again, I can't drift off into why that connection makes sense with giant clans and whatnot. Again, this is material that's a bit beyond, well, a good bit beyond what we covered in Unseen Realm. It's the kind of thing, I have this on my possible list of topics, you know, for the Naked Bible, you know, cruise in October, but we'll see when we get there. But this is, again, a big deal. It's an obvious application and a set of prohibitions that derive from, again, the early commands of the Decalogue. Now, in Exodus 22, verses 20 through 26, we get a series of social justice commands. I'll just read you a few of them here. He says, "You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless." So this is, again, a pretty severe, you know, situation from God's perspective. Now, Sarna writes, "Four social groups especially vulnerable to exploitation are now singled out as being the object of God's special concern. These are the stranger, the widow, the orphan, and the poor. The Torah here enjoins sensitivity to their condition, not simply out of humanitarian considerations, but as a divine imperative. Insensitivity is consequentially sinful, a violation of the commandment that expresses God's will. A striking feature of the Hebrew legal formulation is the manner in which the audience is addressed in the singular and the plural, following the pattern of the Decalogue." This is the Decalogue, and it actually does this too, refers to whoever's in view in both singular and plural terms. "It recognizes," Sarna continues, "both the individual and society as equally responsible and accountable for the terms of the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Social evil is thus a sin against God and humanity." Now, I want to throw some thoughts out here in light of that. You know, the reason, again, the singular and plural thing is ultimately because the nation collectively is going to enter into a covenant with Yahweh. We're going to see that in Exodus 24. Well, that's all well and good, but here's what I want to throw out. This doesn't apply to modern states by definition, because A, they aren't theocracies. They're not new Israels, okay? And B, those nations, modern nations, have never enacted a covenant with Yahweh. A better analogy than state power is the church, the people of God now. When we make no attempt to address social evils, we do wrong. That ought to be obvious, but the more difficult question for us today is, by what means? Now, the church is not a theocratic state, and it's not intended to be a theocratic state. It is not attached to specific geography, nor is the Great Commission concerned with gaining and holding geography. So the modern notions of statehood and this and the church, this is apples and oranges, okay? The principle, though, of God's people trying to address and protect, you know, the most vulnerable, I mean, that's a legitimate application. You know, what we have going on here is about God using believers to save people. You know, in the Great Commission, God is using believers to save people from all the nations to incorporate them into his family. Again, that's what we're tasked to do. It's God's job at the day of the Lord and return of Christ to judge the nations. That's not our job as the church, you know, as God's people. What's in view here, again, is believers, the people of God individually and as the believing community, i.e. the church today. We're supposed to do what we can to alleviate suffering and to make sure people are treated justly according to God's morality, God's good justice. You know, believers we're supposed to address this stuff. We're supposed to address social evils individually and corporately as the community of believers. We're not supposed to hand that responsibility to the state, is what I'm ultimately trying to get to here. We, as the church, are not a state. We are not a theocratic state. We are not supposed to make our states in the modern world theocracies. That is not the Great Commission. On the other hand, instead of that misguided thinking, we as individual Christians, we as believing communities, our own local churches, we're supposed to do what we can to alleviate this sort of suffering and to address social problems. Again, not with the intent of, oh, we need to turn the America into a theocracy and get it back to, you know, being a, no, we're not the new Israel. America is not the new Israel. Okay, you could say the church, the believing community, the family of God, you could say, is a new Israel, okay, because the New Testament does use that language. But again, the intent of that is not to set up a theocracy. The intent of that is to go out into all the world, like the Great Commission says, and win people through the gospel and bring them back into the family. Okay, we tend, you know, Christians today, too many of them tend to conflate all these things and not think carefully about their nuances. Now, what I just described is not what's known today as the social gospel. You know, God forbid. The social gospel redefines the gospel as good works on behalf of the poor and downtrodden. It's a bait and switch. It redefines the gospel as addressing social problems. That is not the gospel. While we should do that, while we should address social problems, none of that is the gospel. Rather, a better way to think about it is all of that stuff is pre-evangelism. It's pre-gospel stuff. It creates goodwill toward people who need the real gospel. It gives Jesus a good reputation so that people will listen to the gospel. It's not a substitute for the gospel. Now, let me just tack on one other thought. It's hopelessly inconsistent for progressive, and I really don't like that term, because progressive often isn't progressive at all. It's regressive and just a whole lot of other things. But it's hopelessly inconsistent for progressive Christians to advocate social justice on the basis of these and other passages, whose context is a theocracy, by the way, and then explode with rage when other Christians want to use the same Bible to exalt biblical morals about sexuality and marriage and protecting the unborn. That is hopelessly inconsistent. And you've got certain political candidates out there doing this now, quoting Bible passages to prop up abortion and, you know, other social programs. But then when you turn around and you talk about other things that are in the same Torah or the same Bible, they just flip out. Again, it's hopelessly inconsistent. It is a hermeneutic of hypocrisy to say that you're taking God's side on just a select list of causes or issues. And you also can't assign the sexuality material of the Bible to culture and then pretend that other social causes aren't cultural but absolute. Again, it's a totally inconsistent hermeneutic. You're cherry picking for the sake of your list and to pretend you're on the side of biblical authority, and it's a self-serving approach to Scripture. You know, other than that, I don't have any thoughts about it. Again, I think you can tell this is something that really irritates me. It bothers me not only when we have an inconsistent hermeneutic like this to prop up a political cause or a political opinion. The church is not the state. The church isn't supposed to be the state. It's not supposed to turn the state into a theocracy either. Both sides of the political spectrum get this wrong. I just don't know how much clearer Jesus could have been. My kingdom is not of this world. I don't see how that's ambiguous. My kingdom is not of this world. Where's the ambiguity? We should not be handing over our responsibility to the state. And you say, well, how in the world can all these social problems be addressed one person at a time? It's the same answer to the question of how in the world can the Great Commission be accomplished? It's one person at a time. The math is on our side. I've had this presentation before about just working the numbers, the demographics. If every Christian won some, you know, person to the Lord every year and discipled them, and every Christian helped out take away somebody's suffering pre-evangelism, you know, getting them ready to hear the gospel, and again, giving Jesus a good reputation so that they'll actually listen to the gospel. Again, good works is not the gospel. The social gospel is a different gospel. Okay, think of it as social works, good works, that's pre-evangelism. It's pre-gospel. It's setting the stage for a hearing for the real gospel. It's not a substitute. If every Christian did that to one other person, every year, and then all those other Christians, either in terms of winning people or doing good things to people, if they all simultaneously repeated that with just one person every year, the exponential numbers are on our side. It's like 10 or 12 years before like the population of the world is covered. That's how it's supposed to be done. The church, Christians, are not supposed to be handing over pre-evangelism works and then pretending they're doing the gospel when the state is taking care of something, supposedly, badly, usually. and then pretend that they're doing God's work by handing this over to the state, growing the state and diminishing personal responsibility from believers. That's just abominable. But that's where we are. That's where a lot of churches are, even believing churches. Again, I could go off on this for a long time because I do think about it a lot. But again, we need to go back and finish our chapter. So back to the ancient mindset now. You know, these humanitarian stipulations, Sarna says, have been set down after the preceding cultic laws in order to establish a contrast between the moral corruption of paganism. You say, well, why are the weird laws about the witch and bestiality and idolatry? Why is that juxtaposed to this social justice stuff? Well, Sarna says, look, it's supposed to establish a contrast between the moral corruption of paganism and the moral nature of the God of Israel. Okay? And boy, does it do that or not. I mean, God is angry when these people are mistreated. And the pagans are out there doing, you know, God knows what. They're not caring about this. You know, people are imagers. You know, this is biblical theology. It's biblical thinking. The prohibition against idolatry was designed, again, to reinforce the idea that God chooses who or what images him, and he has made man his imager. When he shows up in visible form, he says to people, now don't make any visible form, you know, that it's supposed to be me. Don't, even if it's in your head and your heart that this is Yahweh and we're bowing, don't do it. You are not supposed to bow to anything made by human hands. But when God chooses to show up, how does he show up most of the time? As a human. Again, the theological messaging that goes with that, I hope, doesn't escape you. You know, and if you're thinking about that, it helps you. You think about the concept of imaging, thinking about God's preference for making himself known as a human being, you know, and human beings are his imagers. Then mistreatment of fellow humans is a violation of the way God wants not only your culture to function, your society, your church, the believing family, not only wants that to function that way, but it's actually a violation of the principle of how God wants to be worshiped or not. And it still goes back to the connection, you know, with the Decalogue. Now, the end of the chapter, we're just going to wrap up here. There's a section about interest and loans and the poor, which is, you know, kind of interesting. I'll read you a little bit of what Sarna says, but I don't want this to go too long. Again, there's so much in the passage that, you know, we could comment on. But Sarna writes this, the laws aimed, again, this is Exodus 22, 24 through 26. The laws are aimed at protecting the desperate poor from exploitation by the more fortunate. They are the first of several such laws in the Torah that regulate loans and forbid the taking of interest. The others are Leviticus 25, 35 through 38, Deuteronomy 23, 20 and 21, Deuteronomy 24, 10 through 13. The association of loan giving with the poor provides the social background to the prohibition. Prior to Solomon's time, Israelite society was composed overwhelmingly of peasants in villages operating in an agrarian economy. Tribal affiliation carried with it the obligation of mutual cooperation and support. In these circumstances, the need for a loan would be occasioned not by business and commerce, but by dire poverty. Those who habitually lived at little more than subsistence level would need to borrow either money or grain if disaster struck. The taking of interest was therefore a moral, not an economic issue. To do so was to shirk responsibility to one's fellow Israelite and to profit from another's misery. It also opened the door to the eventual enslavement of the borrower and his family, since in most instances the payment of the interest, let alone repayment of a loan, was unfeasible. The present laws, like similar ones found elsewhere in the Torah, are designed to safeguard the dignity and protect the means of subsistence of the impoverished debtor. True, several biblical texts indicate that there were times when the ideal was ignored in practice. Nevertheless, biblical law is unique in the ancient Near East in imposing an absolute ban on lending and borrowing with interest. In the urbanized and commercial society of Mesopotamia, loans on interest were commonplace and regulated by both law and custom. Loan contracts from Newsy show that rates of interest at times reached 50% per annum per year. The laws of Eshnunna and Hammurabi pay attention to loans. Generally, interest rates specify 33.3% per annum on loans of grain and 20-25% on loans of silver. The system resulted in the granting of legal sanction to the practice of seizing the non-paying debtor or members of his family and depriving them of their freedom. And that's the end of the Sarna quote. That's the point of these laws. again, their own cultural context is, you know, a society where you were supposed to take care of each other, you know, as fellow Israelites, members of this covenantal relationship with Yahweh. Again, I think that applies very, very nicely to the church, you know, but again, even if you want to dispute charging interest of another Christian and all that sort of stuff, I understand we're not a theocracy and all that. The real principle here is to avoid the debasement and to not extend the vulnerability of people. I mean, the ancient Near Eastern interest rates, as we just read those examples, you know, they're the most common examples that you could cite here, are exorbitant. And they create the set of circumstances that create debt slavery. You know, that is unique in the Hebrew Bible in that circumstance is what is specifically to be avoided. And the Bible does this in other ways, like the Jubilee year and all this kind of stuff. You are not supposed to do this kind of thing, you know, to people, you know, to members of, at least members of your own community. Now, outside, again, Sarna comments on Deuteronomy 23:21. That passage permits the exaction of interest on loans made to a foreigner, that is, to one who resides in an Israelite locality only temporarily. Likewise, debts incurred by a foreigner are not canceled in the sabbatical year, Deuteronomy 15:3. These distinctions are drawn because the foreigner referred to would most likely be a traveling trader who takes a loan for commercial and business reasons. Because of his mobility, such an individual would constitute a high risk, like he could just never come back. This situation is well documented in the ramified and far-flung trading operations carried on in the Assyrian Empire, which were financed through private enterprise. It's the end of the Sarna quote. But there's all sorts of examples of what he just cited where you would, you know, within an Israelite context, we'll just keep this, you were allowed to charge interest of a foreigner, someone who was not a member of the community, because of some of these logistical reasons. I mean, that sets the context. You know, so if they repaid you, you would get a little bit, you know, more back, you know, potentially. It also might create a set of circumstances where people would be hesitant to borrow from you, at least initially, feeling that they were under this obligation. But within the community, and the bigger principle here, within the community, and this is a theft issue, if you do this thing that you're forbidden from doing to members of your community, you know, financially, if you go ahead and do that, you're guilty of theft. It's an extension, again, of the Decalogue, this idea. But, you know, you're not supposed to create the set of circumstances that, again, would create the possibility of debt slavery. This is something to be scrupulously avoided. And even within the community, even if some set of circumstances evolves or devolves where a person is in this situation, disaster strikes or whatever, that even that was limited by the Jubilee idea. So, again, it gives you some context for how things are at least thought about. I don't really have time to comment on the last verse here, Exodus 23:19. This is where we would quit. You know, the whole thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. I will say this only. I have a friend who went through the UW program and then went to Harvard. His name is Andy Teeter. He teaches at Harvard Divinity School. Now, he came out with a really, really super technical article on this where he looks at the Dead Sea Scrolls and rabbinic parallels, as well as text critical data from the Samaritan Pentateuch. You know, it's quite dense. But he argues that the point of the prohibition, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk, it's akin to saying you should not commit premature sacrifice of the contents of the womb. I mean, this was something that you were not supposed to do. Now, you could do this accidentally. You didn't know it was pregnant. I don't know how if you're an agrarian culture, you should kind of know that. But that was, you know, considered something ritually disallowable. And so it's another way of saying the same thing. Deuteronomy 4:21, Exodus 34:26 has laws about not sacrificing, you know, a newborn and the mother on the same day. And so this is just a different way of making the same point. And that's Andy's argument, is that that's really what it means. It's not anything about, you know, Canaanite religion or something like that. It's just, you know, here you go. Even though the Canaanites, you know, would have cared less. So there's a connection there, you know, and with certain, you know, rituals, there could be a connection to idolatry. Okay, well, nobody's going to deny that. But the real point here is another way of expressing the same idea of those other two passages. So that's our little foray again through the covenant code, again, Book of the Covenant. And I realize it was hit or miss, but the point I want to reinforce as we wrap up here is, look, it's strange. These things don't look like they go together. The order is haphazard. Like, what in the world is going on here? And part one deals with how difficult the situation can be and how convoluted it can be. Everybody knows that, again, who deals with this section. But the thing to recognize is it is what it is because they are illustrating, they are living out, they are trying to apply the much more simple, but still at times ambiguous, laws from the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. Again, that we just, you know, spent 3 weeks, three episodes covering the actual Decalogue. So that's what this section is about. And what we're going to do now is we're going to move on. When we come back to Exodus, we're going to move on into the angel passage. We'll say a little bit about that. But eventually, we're going to get to the actual covenant ceremony. And then, you know, into some of the other stuff that Exodus is known for, like building the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, all that stuff. So we're almost there as well. But this is the end of our little foray into the legislation.
All right, Mike. Well, Q&A next time, so I got to get you a bunch of questions for our Q&A yep. next week, and we'll take a break from Exodus, and we'll pick it back up. And then, Mike, after that, it's our conference. If you're not going to be able to make it to the conference, live stream it. Go to nakedbibleconference.com, get the information about live streaming it, and watch it for about 3 months, and then we have plans for it later. But if you can't make it, at least you can live stream it, so don't miss that. We hope you can join us. And with that, Mike, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.